Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, October 27th. Facebook, in the crisis of its life, over its role in the crisis of other people's lives. The crisis at Facebook is being caused by internal documents that are being called the Facebook Papers and have been shared with a consortium of news organizations by whistleblower Frances Haugen. Here are a few of the headlines the Facebook Papers have generated in the last few days. From the New York Times, internal alarm, public shrugs, Facebook's employees dissect its election roll. From HuffPost, Facebook froze as anti-vax comments swarmed users. From Vox, Wall Street doesn't care about the Facebook leaks. Mark Zuckerberg does. USA Today, from just this morning, Instagram's dangers to children unite liberal and conservative lawmakers who agree on little else. And a few more from the Times. In India, Facebook grapples with amplified version of its problems, and Instagram struggles with fear of losing its pipeline, young users. With me now is the writer of all those New York Times articles, Shira Frankel, Times technology reporter and co-author of the book, An Ugly Truth, Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. Shira, thanks for coming on today. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I want to walk you through some of the stories that you tell in these articles. I think the listeners will find it really interesting to go point by point through a couple of them. So let's begin with your article, Internal Alarm, Public Shrugs, Facebook's Employees Dissect Its Election Roll. It begins with a Facebook employee who opened an experimental account in 2019, and she quickly discovered something alarming. Want to start with that story?
Sure. So this Facebook employee is a long-term researcher who likes to run these kinds of experiments. She joins Facebook as a new user and then see where Facebook's algorithms take her. In this case, she wanted to be a new user who was a Christian woman based somewhere in the United States. And that was essentially all the information she gave Facebook. And what she found was within just a matter of weeks, Facebook's algorithms were pushing her towards extreme content. And by that, I mean fringe conspiracy theories like QAnon, militia groups. I mean, the type of stuff that Facebook says that it bans and that it doesn't want to push people towards, it was giving this person that had just joined the platform.
And then you go on to another Facebook employee raising an alarm. On November 5th last year, that first one was 2019, November 5th last year, 3 days after Election Day, what did that employee see?
So what they start to see is that the amount of election misinformation is just overwhelming, and that the safeguards that the company said that it put in place, the break glass measures is what Facebook was calling it, were just not working. It wasn't effective. And I think that, you know, it was interesting for us as reporters to see that here we are, incredibly important elections in the United States, and this employee is sounding the alarm very early on to say something's going wrong here. Our measures are not working.
Let's keep going. Just 4 days later, November 9th last year, yet another Facebook employee, one of their data scientists, reported up the chain that an alarming 10% of all U.S. views of political material on Facebook were posts that claimed the election results were fraudulent. So what did Facebook do with any of that information?
What did they do? They didn't do much outside of their plan. I mean, they did enact some additional break glass measures that they had prepared. And it was a lot of kind of brow furrowing and employees asking one another why their company was being used in that way. But yes, you don't see them go into crisis mode. You don't see them taking some of the more extreme steps that those same researchers were proposing to them.
And one more story before we dig into what Facebook could have done, according to its employees. From your article, in India, Facebook grapples with an amplified version of its problems. That article also starts with a Facebook researcher setting up an account just to see what would happen, but this time in Kerala, India, and with a really simple and interesting game plan. Follow all the recommendations generated by Facebook's algorithms and see what happened. So what happened?
Right. And this is actually, we don't note it in our articles, but this is the same researcher who set up the profile of a young American woman goes and runs the same experiment in India. And she sets up this account. And she, again, very little information. She just says that she's based in Kerala, India, and she wants to see what Facebook tells her to do. What groups does it tell her to join? What pages does it tell her to follow? And within a matter of weeks, she is inundated with violent content, hate speech, misinformation. This is a time where India and Pakistan are actually, tensions are running very, very high. There's been a suicide attack along the border there. And what she finds is just by following the recommendations that Facebook surfaces for her, she is driven to believe all these conspiracies about the suicide bombing that happened along the India-Pakistan border. And she could see how people on the platform would be, it would be fed incredibly divisive and polarizing content if they were just brand new to Facebook and joining the platform looking for information.
Sherry, you note that India is Facebook's largest market, and I know India has 1 billion people, second largest country in the world by population, but some people might still be surprised to hear that Facebook is so prevalent there. Why India?
Well, Facebook was really aggressive about entering the market in India. They made these deals with local telecom carriers, which made it pretty much free to get Facebook. If you were getting a phone, you would have a version of the Facebook app on your phone, which was great for messaging friends, for doing business. It became incredibly prevalent because it was so inexpensive. And this is a country where you often have to pay for data on your phone, and it can be very prohibitive for the average person to have to pay for all that data. So if you were given a cheap alternative, you can see how people were drawn to it. Facebook also did a lot of marketing in India. It really wanted to be in this country. And I think it's interesting now looking and reading their internal documents about how much they struggle to secure the elections in India, how complicated they found India's voting system. This is a voting process that lasts for over a month. It is a country which has over 22 official languages. This is not an easy environment to regulate content in or to monitor content in. And yet Facebook pushed very aggressively into that market and then found itself struggling and only able to monitor content in, I think, 3 of the 22 languages, or 4 rather, if you include English. And so you see a company sort of in love with the idea of doing business in India, in love with the idea of this billion person market that it can potentially capture, but they're not really able to, I think at least what these documents show, is not really able to keep up with the sheer volume of what it's taken on.
You know, as we debate the extent of Facebook's role in disinformation and allowing disinformation in this country and allowing this country to be torn apart over falsehoods about the election and vaccines and other things, how is this affecting politics or other aspects of life in India that you were just describing over there?
Well, we see time and again that the kind of conspiracies that we worry about here in the United States are amplified tenfold when they reach other countries. And when I say that, I'm really thinking specifically about the pandemic, about the start of the pandemic and what COVID was and how it spread. And then, all the early narratives about the vaccine that anti-vaccine activists wanted to spread. I was doing some research for this India story that I reported for The Times, and I was just astounded at the anti-vaccine content that I found being spread in India to its user base there. And I think a big reason for that is that Facebook, what we found, now the startling figure that came out of these documents, Facebook dedicates 87% of its budget on misinformation to combating misinformation here in the United States. And by that, that's an umbrella kind of that covers hate speech and conspiracies and everything else. Mm-hmm. So 87% of that budget goes to the United States. 13% goes to the entire rest of the world. And let's put that figure in context. Facebook has more people using its platform in India than in the United States, just one country in the rest of the world. So you can see how here in America, they might struggle, but they are somewhat effective in taking down conspiracies about the vaccine, right? And allegations that the vaccine isn't effective and all the rest of that stuff. How can they possibly be effective in the rest of the world when they're spending just 13% of their budget on it?
Any other countries you might want to add to the U.S. and India? I mean, I hear those whopping
right.
statistics that you just gave with respect to India, and of course the U.S., but where similar things are taking place, any others?
Yeah, I mean, I think about Myanmar a lot, Sri Lanka, Indonesia, Ethiopia, just around the time that we had our elections here in the United States, Ethiopia saw an outbreak of violence, partially, it seems, spurred by rumors that were spread on Facebook. I think that there's you'd be hard pressed to find a country in the world that has not been affected by misinformation spread on Facebook.
Sujata in Summit, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sujata.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to, you know, reiterate what the previous caller just said, that, you know, WhatsApp conspiracy theories are just, you know, a dime a dozen in India and circulated endlessly by, you know, by sort of everyone in India uses WhatsApp. But not sure you had a question for me.
Oh, well, it sounds like you told our screener this includes some of your family members, right?
Yeah, you know, my husband's family, they just, thankfully not mine, but it's just insane conspiracy theories that are circulated, and there's you know, there's issues with things that are non-issues. So, for instance, in the U.S., it's a mask, right? Like, wear a mask, and that's that. But here, it's like Diwali, the Indian festival is coming up, and, you know, usually to control pollution, there is a narrative saying, hey, don't burst crackers because it just, you know, pollutes the air. Mm-hmm. But now it's being like, this is a very anti-Hindu thing to say. I mean, they've removed the pollution aspect of it out, but are centering it on religion, which says that, you know, because your people are being anti-Hindu when they say that you shouldn't be bursting firecrackers. That's one of the examples.
Right. Encouraging division, basically.
100%. And, you know, I was telling someone, the lady who was taking my call earlier, I read this article on Slate.com yesterday, you know, which spoke about how the head of public policy for Facebook in India basically was very, you know, comfortable with the ruling party and all of the members of the ruling party just saying whatever it is that they wanted to say without enforcing any restrictions on them. She stepped down from her role. She was not fired. So she resigned eventually. But they've got another person, and again, the article states that the person is similar. So they get the Facebook gets a lot of its revenue in India from members of the ruling party, and it's almost like they don't want to rock that boat, because why would you? It's a money making machine. People say all kinds of you know, hideous and crazy things to people that get amplified and circulated, and you know, it's there's money all over it.
Sujata, thank you so much for your call. As we continue with Shira Frankel, New York Times technology reporter and co-author of the book An Ugly Truth, Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. Well, Shira, for one thing, did you notice how Sujata threw her in-laws, disowned she disowned her in-laws there? I said, oh, you told our screener that this is happening in your family. She said, well, my husband's family. So there go the in-laws.
We all have someone. I mean, I have people in my family who I find spreading misinformation and conspiracies. And it's always a funny conversation. I actually remember around the time of the U.S. elections, I had to get in touch with a family member because they were spreading a conspiracy that I had personally spent time debunking on the New York Times. And I sent that person my article and I said, hey, just, you know, FYI, I've actually written about this. And we still had a very lengthy argument about it. I don't think they believed me, but it's always hard when it's in your own family.
Sure, your articles frame an uncertainty, I think it's fair to say, over whether to think Facebook tried to contain disinformation, at least about the election in this country, but it's really hard to do when you have 3 billion individual users versus Facebook didn't really try to contain the disinformation because it was profiting from the extra user engagement that all the election activity was bringing, and user engagement is at the heart of their business model. But you say the documents that you've obtained show that Facebook's own employees believe that the company could have done more. So what do these employees believe it could have done?
Right. So these employees that we look at in these documents, they're an interesting group because a lot of them work for Facebook's civic integrity unit. This is their specialty. This is what they were hired to do. And of those, quite a few have a background in research. Some of them are trained as data scientists. So they're looking at this purely from the point of view of, given the tools Facebook has has at its disposal? What could it do to make things better? And I think what they show time and time again is, you know, here's a step we can take. For instance, on vaccine misinformation, they find that if you disable all comments on posts related to the vaccine, you'll reduce vaccine misinformation because Facebook does not seem to have the ability to adequately monitor content in its comments. And yet they're told by executives, well, no, we can't do that. Because the moment we do that, we get less engagement on Facebook. People are less interested in spending time on our platform. Fewer eyeballs mean, you know, less ad revenue. It means less data on people. And so the company executives who are thinking about this as a business are coming at it from one point of view, while the civic integrity team is really just thinking about, I think, the health of democracy and the health of society. I think one thing that was telling for me when I was working on the book was one of Mark Zuckerberg's earliest speechwriters writes and tells the story of how he used to end company meetings by saying company over country. And I just wonder, you know, he has been the founder of that company, the chief executive. He is completely in control. And if that is the mentality going in, company over country, you can see how so many of these decisions would be made downwind of that.
Now, on that Vox headline I cited in the intro, Wall Street doesn't care about the Facebook leaks. Mark Zuckerberg does. The Wall Street part of that is that Facebook stock does not seem to be taking a hit because of the Facebook papers. But it includes a clip of Zuckerberg on Monday, largely blaming the media and critics with an agenda rather than the company's own policies for the hits its reputation is taking. Listen.
Good faith criticism helps us get better. But my view is that what we are seeing is a coordinated effort to selectively use leaked documents to paint a false picture of our company. The reality is that we have an open culture where we encourage discussion and research about our work so we can make progress on many complex issues that are not specific to just us.
Mark Zuckerberg at a public presentation of quarterly earnings on Monday. Shira Frankel still with us from the New York Times. Shira, do you give Zuckerberg's argument there any credence? Is there a complexity that maybe some of the reporting, not yours, but some of the reporting in simpler news organizations is missing in favor of an overly simplistic narrative of Facebook coddling disinformation for financial gain?
I'll be honest, I haven't been able to read all the articles that have come out because there's been dozens and dozens of articles. I think that you know, of the articles I have read in the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, AP, I have seen some really fantastic reporting that has delved into these documents. Is it complete? Does it have the 360-degree view that I imagine Mark Zuckerberg has? No. And I imagine it's not black and white because of all the reporting we've done, we haven't, you know, seen any examples where Mark Zuckerberg or Sheryl Sandberg or anybody else at the top of the company makes a decision out of malice. They're not, I think you could say, they're not evil people. They're not sitting there, you know, I forget the name of the character from Austin Powers, you know, twiddling their thumbs and saying, how do we destroy the world? That's not what they're doing as a company. And I think they do take some measures that are advised by these researchers. However, you know, I think he's trying to portray it in a certain way. I think you can also look at these documents and say, if they're given a 1 through 5 option, where 5 is the most effective but loses them people, and 1 is the least effective but doesn't lose them any users, they're not going to choose the most effective and risk losing those users. They're not going to risk hitting their bottom line. That is not how they're operating as a company.
Right. The USA Today headline I cited in the intro says, Instagram's dangers to children unite liberal and conservative lawmakers who agree on little else. So, assuming that common ground, how much is Washington divided on the main Facebook platform along the lines of, you know, Democrats say Facebook doesn't stop disinformation enough, and Republicans say their politics of the right are singled out for censorship?
You know, for a very long time, Democrats and Republicans have been divided along the very lines that you just described. It's become a free speech argument. And as we know, you know, America cares very much about the First Amendment. It is a very complicated argument. And this is actually a really great place for Facebook to have people divided on, right? If we're busy talking about the First Amendment and what should Facebook monitor and what specific pieces of content are appropriate to remove versus those that aren't, you can see how you would get bogged down in that for decades, really. But I think what we're starting to see now, and what I certainly saw in the last Senate hearing, was members across the aisle looking at this in a different way. They're not asking the question of, should you be allowed to say something on Facebook? They're asking the question of, should Facebook be promoting it? If you want to share a conspiracy and say that the earth is flat, for instance, fine, say that, say the earth is flat. But should Facebook push people into groups that try to convince them that the earth is flat? That is where senators are now focusing their attention. And I think that's something that Republicans and Democrats can both get around, because we're talking about Facebook's decision as a company over promoting things, over pushing things to people. I sometimes think of this as the equivalent of, like, you know, soda companies. Should Pepsi, Cola, whatever, be allowed to sell their product? Sure. But should they place them in the hallways of schools where elementary kids are encouraged to buy them? Probably not, right? Like, that's probably something we've moved against. We've said, that's not a great idea to put them right there accessible to small kids. So we're focusing on the decisions Facebook makes as a business and what it recommends, rather than the decisions of individuals and what they post.
So do all these politics add up to any likely new laws or regulations that could actually be helpful? Even Mark Zuckerberg says, regulate me, please.
Well, he wants regulation, but he wants a specific kind of regulation. He wants regulation of the first type I've described. If members of Congress go down that path and say, okay, here are very specific rules about what you must take down, that makes Facebook's life really easy, because all it needs to do is follow those rules. And as we all know, the nature of misinformation, disinformation warfare is that it's always changing. So if you make a rule saying take down these five conspiracies, within, you know, weeks or months, new conspiracies will arise, which are not part of that list. And then Facebook will be able to kind of shrug its shoulders and say, well, you know, Congress didn't tell me to take that down. Take it up with Congress. It's their responsibility to tell me what to take down. This is a great model for Facebook. And I think that it is something that they have, you know, they've been open to, because it's easy for them. I think it's very, very different if lawmakers do head down the path of, what should Facebook be recommending to people? What should its algorithms be pushing?
Well, I think we've established that Mark Zuckerberg is not Dr. Evil from Austin Powers. But short of that, there's a lot of room for debate. Shira Frankel, New York Times technology reporter and co-author of the book, An Ugly Truth, Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. We'll keep following your reporting. It's been fascinating, coming out almost day by day as you get to dig deeper into these Facebook papers leaked by employees. Thank you so much for sharing this with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.